Another big incident was one of my Marines shot himself on the phone with me, on speakerphone with my wife, Sunday night sitting on the couch. He shot himself on the phone, and we heard it all and heard his wife screaming all the same time. A lot of those things I had like compressed so far that they all started coming back at one time, and I just had like a nervous breakdown basically, to the point to where the whole right side of my body shut down and was paralyzed, and I couldn't walk or use the right side of my body for like 3 months. And it was all mental. My brain just shut the whole right side of my body down.
Welcome to Your Story Doesn't End Here, the mental health podcast of military and veterans who refuse to be silenced. I'm your host, Rachel, and my mission with this podcast is to be a voice for those who don't have a voice, bring awareness to mental health issues, provide value and solutions, and to change the culture when it comes to mental health within the DoD organizations. Hey, everyone, and thank you so much for coming back for another episode of Your Story Doesn't End Here. Today's guest is Jonathan Taylor, or JT. He is a former Marine Scout Sniper team leader with 5 combat deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, Executive Vice President of the USMC Scout Sniper Association, Government Acquisition and Project Management Professional, Emotional Resiliency Mentor, husband and father to 2 amazing little girls, and a self-proclaimed karaoke king. Might have to talk a little bit more about that later. JT, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to bore people with my story.
I have this core belief that everyone's story is so important. And I've heard from several people before that they're like, I don't know if my story is that exciting. But I think for me, it's always so intriguing to hear the different experiences that different people have had throughout their life and their service. And so I'm excited to hear what you have to say today, but I'm going to pass it off to you to share your story with the listeners.
Okay, great. Yeah, it took me a while to be able to get to the point to where I was able to, I guess, drop my guard and kind of share my story and go, I wouldn't say public, but be more in the, in the public eye kind of. So I just started that this year, the new journey. Once you get to a certain place in your career, your job, and, family, and you start thinking that you've kind of hit a plateau and you want to kind of find something to kind of get you over that plateau, that's when I decided to start trying to maybe tell my story a little bit. So currently, I am the Executive Vice President of the Scout Sniper Association for the Marine Corps. We are the only nonprofit association that supports Marine snipers and their family. We support them by financial help, finding them mental health, anything that any sniper has issues with, we try to help them, give them assistance in any way we can. We also do some sniper competitions and different things to kind of keep the community together. So that's one thing we do. And that's a nonprofit that I'm a part of right now. I'm also full-time a government acquisitions project manager for the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. So that's my full-time job. And then being a dad and a husband, which is also a full-time job. But I came from very humble beginnings, if you would say. I came from rural Mississippi, a very small town, about 3,000 people. And everybody knows exactly everybody. If you go to Walmart, it's like a family reunion. There's only a couple of restaurants. And I grew up with a teenage single mom. My mom was 17. Father was never around. Actually, mom told me he died when I was little. So I ended up meeting him, though, down the road when I was 10 years old for the first time. So that was kind of a shock. And then had multiple stepfathers. Not to really talk too bad about my mother, but she was very promiscuous, young, and kind of not much guidance. So we kind of grew up together. Me and my mom, and she had multiple men in her life. I witnessed a lot of domestic violence with her, a lot of drugs and alcohol, a lot of moving around. At one time I counted up that I'd lived in 19 different houses by the age of 17, in a one county area. So that's a lot of moving around. There's times we didn't have water, times we didn't have electricity, and the only really stable people that I had in my life as a kid were my grandparents, my mom's parents. They were like the guiding light and the saviors. Whenever things really started to hit the fan, they would swoop in and kind of clean up the pieces and make sure everything was okay. But they wanted my mother to be independent, so they kind of made sure she didn't hit rock bottom, but left her to kind of figure it out. But they were always around if I needed them. So grew up playing sports. Nobody in my family has ever been in the military. I found at a young age that I was very determined to get out of Mississippi and to get out of the environment I was in, just because I could see people that were, friends of family and things like that I was around. I could see what their future was, and I started realizing, if I stay around here, this might be my future as well. So I wasn't a good student, so college wasn't really going to be the thing for me. So military it was, and I was gung ho about being a Navy SEAL my whole life. Started training to be a Navy SEAL, and last minute before I signed up for the military, I switched to the Marines because I couldn't imagine something happening at Navy SEAL school and me getting stuck being in the Navy if I didn't pass. Just because there wasn't anything in the Navy that interested me job wise besides being a SEAL.
I got to laugh because I was Navy, so I get it.
Yeah, I know you're a Navy. But you know the SEALs and regular Navy is two different worlds, I didn't want something to happen. It's kind of the fear of unknown. I didn't want to get something happen to me at Bud's or something, and then I get stuck on a ship painting or standing watch or something like that. So I chose the Marine Corps because we have something kind of equivalent in the Marines called reconnaissance, Marine recon, and I knew that if something happened and I didn't make recon, I could still be a sniper. I could still be infantry. There's all these other things I could do, still kicking indoors, still getting some on the front lines, those kind of things. So I made that decision and never looked back. And that was in 2004. Fallujah had just finished. So we're right in the middle of the Iraqi war, right in the beginning. I joined infantry, said I want to go as soon as possible. So from the time I went in the recruiter's office, so the time I was at boot camp was about 30 days. And then made it through boot camp at Parris Island, fine. Went to infantry school, became a machine gunner off the bat because it was like the hardest thing you could do at infantry school, I thought, because they had to carry the big heavy machine guns around. So did that. And then when I got to the fleet, I got to a unit called 1-2, 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines. And they had just got back from a deployment. In a city called Iskandaria in Iraq. And Iskandaria was a pretty heavy fight. The previous deployment, 1-2, had went to, I can't remember the name of the town, but it was a really big fight. And they had a lot of friendly fire. They had a blue on blue incident that killed like an entire mortar section. So it was the culture in that unit when I got there was very toxic. Very, at this time, nobody knew what PTSD was. Nobody knew what the effects of war were. It hasn't really been studied that much at this point. There was no Wounded Warrior Battalion. So the guys that were coming back wounded, they would just put them on the first floor of the barracks and the corpsman would go check on them every day. So they're just basically there to lay there and rot and drink and take pills. So it was pretty scary being a young person coming out of infantry school, checking into the fleet. You see all these guys walking around bandaged up, burns on their body from IED blast. Some people amputees. Everybody's got fresh tats all over their body, still wrapped with cellophane, because they just got back from deployment, spending all their money. And so it was a pretty rude awakening when you first got to the fleet. But I was able to see very quickly that anywhere is what you make of it. And you can't take people's word for face value when you get to a new unit. You have to figure it out for yourself. And you have to make your own opinion. And, the shit or the people that are shit will flock together and try to attract more shit with them. So you got to kind of know where to navigate who to be around and who not to be around. Some of my peers weren't able to do that, and they get sucked right in. And a lot of discipline issues, a lot of NJPs, because most of these guys were 4 years and out. They didn't really care. They were going to combat 2 times in their 4 years, getting out and moving on with their life. So, but I knew I wanted more out of the Marine Corps than just that. And I knew I wanted to be around a better, more capable individuals. That's why I tried out for snipers. So in the Marine Corps, every infantry battalion has a sniper platoon. And the sniper platoon is in general support of the whole battalion. So the sniper platoon is made up of, I guess, probably like the top 1% of the infantry battalion people. You know, they volunteer, you go try out. You have to first you pass a SRB screening, you have to have a first class PFT, you have to have expert rifle score, all these things. And then if they accept you into the indoctrination, it's a 2 to 3 week evolution. And it's basically just to see if you got balls or not. It's just to break you. I mean, from the time they say go to the time it's over, it's nonstop, balls to the wall. I think my indoc, we had 26 show up, and 7 of us finished it, and 8, and they kept 6. And so the 6 of us that they kept, we became members of the sniper platoon, and we're getting ready to do a workup and deploy out to Iraq very, very quickly. And like I said, at this point, the turnover was so high in the Marine Corps that guys were doing 3 years and out, 3 years and out. So a lot of the units that kept redeploying quickly were redeploying basically with a whole new group of Marines than they had the year before. So there was a big learning curve. You were forced into leadership positions early without really being groomed, and you just kind of had to figure it out. So I became a sniper team leader basically right off the bat. Went to sniper school, struggled, but made it through, graduated, and then basically I was team leader. I was a Lance Corporal, sniper team leader, in charge of, 6 other Marines and their lives, and running sniper operations in Iraq, coordinating, doing my mission planning with the battalion commander and all the company COs and the OPSO and just little Lance Corporal Taylor from Mississippi.
I want to ask you, I want to interrupt you for a second. What were your emotions like at this time?
I was nervous, but I was very excited because at the time, everything up until that point was like I was working for that dream, working for that dream. And then finally, now I'm the guy. And, you don't really realize it until you've got 5 or 6 other guys that are looking at you for all the answers. All the answers, because I was the only one out of my whole team that had been to sniper school. So usually each team leader has to be a school trained sniper, and you have to pass sniper school. In that platoon, we deployed with 5 teams, and we had 5 team leaders, 5 school trained snipers. So the only people in the whole platoon that were school trained were the team leaders, which that's not that was common during that time frame. But further on to like OI in the OEF and in Afghanistan, it was not very common. There was usually at least 2 or 3 guys out of each team that was school trained. So not only that, but the officers can't go to Marine Scout Sniper School. So all of the officers that I had to brief and I had to do mission planning and do all these operations with didn't really know much either. So they're looking for me for guidance. I'm Lance Corporal E3, and I'm basically telling COs, captains, majors, how to properly employ my team, what kind of capabilities we have for you, what we can do to help shape the battlefield, how you can use us, how you can emplace us. And they're just all ears, and it's kind of good. It felt good to have that on my shoulders, because I just felt like I was built from a young age to take on a lot, and I was ready to do it. And I excelled, honestly. I excelled at it. I did great. Did 2 deployments there with 1-2, and then re-enlisted, transitioned over to another unit that we started up from scratch for the Afghani war. It's called 3-9, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines. Became a team leader and the chief scout of the platoon. I was a senior sniper in the platoon at that point. So it's kind of like the platoon sergeant, but you're still an operating sniper. You're basically the leader of all the team leaders. And then at that point, I was the subject matter expert basically in my battalion for anything sniper related, sniper operations. So it was a pretty good feeling to know that, once again, your career progression, you just keep going, and you kind of build a name for yourself, and you get all the confidence of your leaders. And then once those things start happening, that's when you start getting the freedom of operation to be able to shift and guide your operations to ensure that you're affecting the battlefield, not just getting sent out on dumb missions. Yeah, my team wants to go out, but what needs to be intel-driven missions? We want to kill somebody. I don't want to go out and sit. I want to go with a purpose, and we want to drop bodies. We want to impact the battlefield. We want this area to know that there are snipers out here and they will kill you. So best to leave the area. And that's
Were
what we did.
there a lot of those missions that were just not intel driven that were happening at the time?
Yeah, a lot, because they just wanted the volume. They just want us out there, because if you don't know how to properly employ snipers, then you think, well, as long as I've got snipers out there, the longer they're out there, the more they're out there, the more likely they are to kill people, which is not absolutely correct. If you don't have intel-driven missions, you're just wasting the sniper team. You're wasting an asset. You're sending us out there. It's 113, 120 degrees, letting us sit for 3 days in the sun, no shade, living in a hole in the desert, watching an intersection that no IED is coming to. And our op tempo was so high. We were doing like 3 day missions like that. You come back, you refit and rest for 24 hours, and you're going back out on a 3 day missioning. And it's just like for 7 months, boom, 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 boom. And everybody was getting fatigued. Everybody was attitudes. Everybody was getting pissed off. People were starting to fist fight, when we were in the rear. People were pulling guns on each other, pulling knives on each other. I mean, just tensions were high. It was nuts. Because also you got people dying, and you had combat replacements coming in. So at this time, when a unit goes to Iraq or Afghanistan, and you get there, and within the first couple of weeks, that's when you take the majority of your casualties. Not necessarily KIAs, but casualties, injuries overall. Because during that changeover, that's when the enemy knows that you're at most vulnerable. So they start coming at you a lot. And then once they realize that you've got your bearing and the unit is more established, and you got logistics set up, and you're ready to start patrolling and securing a battlefield, then they kind of slack off. And then you'll have like a lull of like a couple weeks or a month where nothing will happen. And then it comes in waves. But that first month, you may take 100 casualties in a battalion, and that's not saying KIAs, it's just people that are out of the fight for whatever reason. And so you have to request, they request for combat replacements to come in from the rear, Camp Lejeune. So they'll send in combat replacements. These are guys that aren't in our unit, were not trained with us, we're not familiar with, and they were almost like the plague. You want to stay away from them. It's because combat replacements died a lot. So it's like, all right, combat replacements. Nuh-uh. You guys stay over there. Stay away from us. Let us do our thing. We don't want your bad juju. But it was a great experience. I'm so glad that I made the decision to join the Marines and do that. So the greatest friends I've ever had in my life that I still in super contact with. I've met all of them in the Marine Corps. I rarely have any friends from my childhood that I grew up with. It's all Marines that I served with. And, so thankful that I had that experience.
So, as a leader, when you're over here in combat, and remind me how old you were at the time that you were leading over there overseas.
22 to 24.
So, I mean, you're still pretty young, 22 to
Yeah.
24. And I ask almost every single combat veteran that I have on the show this question, but how do you handle that as a leader when you have all these things thrown at you from new guys coming in, your combat replacements, you have to deal with just being a leader in your job, in your specific job field, but then obviously it's the military, so there's more than just your job field that you have to handle and take on. And you have all these emotions running high. You have people that are, getting pissed off because they're out there forever and doing mundane things. You have people that just don't don't work cohesively with other people. I mean, there's a million things getting thrown at you one time in this environment where it's really not an ideal environment in general because you're in a war environment. So, how do you emotionally handle this, and how do you handle it as a leader, or how did you emotionally handle it, and how did you handle it as a leader at that time?
You know, so you don't have time to evaluate your actions. You just have to react. And for us, there's a lot of mistakes that I made. A lot of mistakes that I made. Not for lack of not trying or caring, but just lack of know. I just didn't know. And, you know, at that young in your career, when you're still at E3, E4, even at E5, you don't get the professional development that you do as like a staffing CEO, or you know, you don't get the leadership classes that you really need, and those types of things are important. But what's more important is just the time in the position, the time as a leader, seeing all the different things being thrown at you and knowing how to react. And we didn't have that. It was just your, here you go, you're the leader, figure it out. And you know, we did the best that we could, and there's a lot of things that I do regret that you know, because I was still immature, still a kid. You know, I look at a 24-year-old now and I say, "You're a kid," you know, and that's how people looked at me probably then. But to me, I thought I was king shit, you know, and so that's, but that's it. But yeah, I've got a lot of regrets from some of my leadership flaws, I guess, during those times. You know, I did the best I could to get everybody home safely, and just trying to figure it out. I wasn't ready. You know, I didn't ask to be in those positions. I was just put up.
Yeah, I hear similar things from probably every combat veteran that I have on here, is that you just don't have time to react or think. You just have to make those quick decisions. So I very much expected that answer from you, but I always like to hear the different answers from people. As far as when you came back from these deployments and you maybe had more time to decompress, or maybe you didn't, I'm curious to hear what your process was when you came back, or maybe you're one of those people that didn't actually fully decompress till you got out, or maybe you still haven't decompressed, but I'm just curious what that process was like for you.
Yeah, for me, so during that phase in my career when I was active like that, I did not have time to decompress. You were just kind of switched on until you knew you were about to be a short timer. You know, so like for me, for my first 3 years, it was just wide open. I didn't have time to do anything. I was just basically learning how to be a Marine, learning how to be a sniper. And then I reenlisted. And then once I reenlisted, you know, but during all these times, we're still doing back-to-back deployments. So I didn't have time to decompress. I didn't know that the, you know, some of the issues that I were having were PTSD related or stress related, or, you know, I didn't even know what stress was. You know, I didn't even realize that I was stressed. I didn't realize that I was drinking and going out and spending money to mask issues that I was having. You know, we were living paycheck to paycheck on purpose. Like, you know, we would have three or four of us on a Friday night when we get our paycheck on the 1st and 15th. We would get together in the barracks room, put our cash together, and say, "All right, this is what we got to spend tonight. Everybody throw me $10. This is for fast food on the way home late night. And other than that, this is what we're partying with." And I mean, we did that every single weekend, every night. I mean, we were just, because you didn't know. You didn't know. It. For all I knew, I was going to die in 6 months. And because other people that we knew from other units, you know, every week you were hearing about, "Oh, hey, did you hear about so and so? Yeah, he died. Did you hear about so? Yeah, he died." And you just can't think about it. So we didn't. We just didn't think about it. I had no emotions. And you know, if you want to push forward through that time now and get to where it all really started coming to an end or to a head for me, that's when I was about to get out in my did my last deployment to Afghanistan. I was married at the time. I'd gotten married during all this chaos. I also got married, which was not good. And then, so I came back from Afghanistan my last time, and my wife at the time, we had horrible financial issues, just like everybody does at that time. And I didn't realize that I had PTSD until a couple of weeks after I'm back, and we're laying in the bed, and I could not sleep without having a knife in my hand or a gun in my hand. I'm talking in my hand. If I couldn't like touch it, I was freaking out. I needed to be able to touch it at any time. And I would jump up for anything and just start beelining right through the house. I would go straight out the door. I would go all the way around my house. I'd come right back in the front door, and I'd go right back to bed. And I would do this like two or three times a night. And it wasn't, and to me, I didn't realize it was PTSD. I thought it was just being vigilant. You know, hey, somebody might be in my house. I need to go check. I just heard something. And she started getting scared because she's like, you know, it's not normal that in the middle of the night, you jump up at a minute's notice with a gun or a knife in your hand and walk straight out of the house outside and go around the house. She's like, that's not normal. Like, I understand that you're trying to be on alert, but that's not. And so I went and talked to a psych about it. And then they basically were like, yeah. And I was at the end of my career anyway. And she was like, yeah, you've got some issues. They diagnosed me with clinical depression. Major clinical depressive order or something like that, and something else. And I got med boarded out, but I was on my way out the door anyway. Got a divorce, got med boarded out. But during that time, I was at Wounded Warrior Battalion when I was phasing out, and that was the first time in my life where I was like vulnerable, and I was like, I'd came to my sense, I everything came to a head. All my deployments came to a head. All the loss of life came to a head. You know, another big incident was one of my Marines shot himself on the phone with me once, on speakerphone with my wife, Sunday night sitting on the couch. He shot himself on the phone, and we heard it all and heard his wife screaming all at the same time. And you know, a lot of those things I'd like compressed so far that they all started coming back at one time, and I just had like a nervous breakdown basically, and I had a nervous breakdown to the point to where the whole right side of my body shut down, and was paralyzed, and I couldn't walk or use the right side of my body for like 3 months, and it was all mental. My brain just shut the whole right side of my body down.
I was going to ask, did you get diagnosed with that as being like a mental or
Yeah,
stress
it
associated
was
thing?
called something phantom something disorder. And basically the doctor explained it to me is where your brain gets to a point to where your brain you're taking on so much in your brain that it has to shut down parts of your body to survive. And that's basically what happened is my brain just kind of shut down the whole right side of my body for about 3 months. I mean, I was on crutch, I was on a cane. It was bad. I didn't know what it was. And I went to all these specialists, went to doctors. You know, nobody could tell me anything. Went to Portsmouth Naval, some of the best nerve doctors. Couldn't tell me anything. Finally, I went to Duke, and a doctor at Duke is one that told me, diagnosed what it was. And he said, usually it comes back, it goes away and you won't ever have it again. But when it's going to go away, I don't know. And then slowly one day I just started waking up and I started getting movement back. And over about a week period, it went away. at that point, and they had me on tons of meds. I've never been on meds before in my life. I hated drugs. I was on all kinds of meds. I was on all kinds of shit. And finally, I quit it all cold turkey, got off of everything, got divorced, which was a big help. And then basically started my life all over when I retired in 2013. Started completely over from scratch.
So when your paralysis happened, did they start working with you on a mental level to help you get better, or did they just throw drugs at you and say, "Hey, let's hope that this fixes it and you get better"?
A little bit of both. They did try. I did try a bunch of different techniques as far as like, what's it called? Like eye relief therapy, all these different types of yoga I was doing. I was doing acupuncture. They really tried a lot of different things to help me, and really nothing helped. I mean, there was nothing that helped.
It just kind of resolved itself on its
It
own
just,
after. Yeah.
I think as the stressors in my life started removing themselves, it just
So
came
when you
back.
say you started your life over in 2013, what did that look like for you? Because I know for some people, starting their life over can be a wonderful experience. For some people, starting their life over can be another stressful experience. And so obviously you're doing a number of different things with your life now. You have children, you are part of this sniper association, which sounds like it's a community for you. And so I'd love to just hear a little bit more about what starting over looked like for you.
So when I say I started over, I retired out medically and was now divorced, had no career, no job, and had no clue what I wanted to do. Had no money, credit was shot, didn't have anything to my name really. So the first thing I did was I moved back home to Mississippi to stay with my grandparents. And I thought I can go back there, stay there for a little bit, and figure out my next moves, get back in school, get a bachelor, get a degree, get back in college, wait for my GI Bill, my VA benefits to start kicking in and those types of things. And then, try to s slowly claw my way back up. And I did that for about 2 months. And after being back in Mississippi for about 2 months, I had made a lot of different contacts. I was about to do an internship with the U.S. Marshals and go to school. And I just seen myself basically doing what I said I didn't want to do when I joined the Marine Corps in the first place, is ending up in Mississippi, doing the same thing. So I knew I wanted to do something. I wanted to take like some time and just go travel and do something that was totally different for me, outside of the box. And I had a friend that lived out in Wyoming, and he said, "You can come stay with me for free. My dad owns an apartment building. You can stay in one of these apartments with me, and we can, just roam around." He's like, he was laid off, or he was like on injury leave or something, workman's comp from the oil field for like 6 months. So he was like, "I got 6 months off of work. We can roam around. You can find something to get into out here. There's plenty of jobs for vets out here." So I loaded up everything I had in an old Land Rover I had and headed out to Wyoming, and got there and met a guy at a VFW, an old army guy who knew somebody that had a big ranch. He was always looking for ranch hands. So that sounds like my job there. So I moved out to a ranch in Wyoming. Was living in a camper for like 6 months and just herding cattle, herding sheep, doing all the ranch duties. Never done anything like that before in my life. I was very preppy, very, I think I had like Calvin Klein jeans and polo shirt the first day I went to the ranch, and the dude's like, "That's what you're wearing to because we were docking sheep the first day. Docking sheep is where you pick up all the baby lamb, all the baby sheep. And then you like sit them over a fence and somebody cuts their tail off. And then
If they're a boy, they clip their balls with a rubber band, and then you put them back down. He's like, "You're wearing that to dock the sheep today?" I was like, "That's all I got." And he's like, "Well, you're gonna have to buy you some old clothes or something." So, anyway, as soon as I went to step over a fence, rip my pants, rip the ass out, and that was my first day. But loved it out there. And while I was out there, I was really able to disconnect, deconnect from life, and I disconnected from everything. Social media. I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't have any social media. I didn't drink. I was abstinent. I was just trying to figure out who I am. Who am I? What is my, do I have a personal philosophy? What is it? What makes me, besides the fact that I was a Marine sniper, what's my identity? What else do I have to offer? And that's really what Wyoming helped me do, is kind of put everything back into perspective and let me know, hey, you're going to be fine. You made it to the pinnacle of your career in the Marine Corps. You're going to keep making it, so just got to take a step back sometimes, and realize that. Realize that there's a lot more to yourself than your losses, and a lot more to yourself than your job, So while I was in Wyoming, started getting back motivated again to join like the professional workforce and start, all right, now I'm ready to get a college degree. Now I'm ready to start doing something. And my nurse case manager from Wounded Warriors reached out to me in an email and told me about this government program in Maryland for the VA. And she said, it's called Warriors to Workforce. It's a VA acquisition internship program. And you move out there to DC and you're in a cohort of other wounded vets. There's like 20 something of us, Army, Navy, Marines. And they put you through a 3-year paid internship program. They bring you in as a GS5. You get all the professional development classes you need. You get your 24 business credit hours, which is what is required to be an acquisitions specialist in the government. And then you can continue taking, and you can finish your degree if you want. And then but the good thing about it is everybody is coming from the same position as you. Everybody's wounded vets, basically, that have no clue what the professional workforce is like. And we're all like wild animals being caged in this professional environment. We've all got suit. You had to wear a suit every day. You had to wear a suit and tie every day to work. And we were just sitting in classes all day, but you had to wear a suit and tie every day. And basically, your project manager is kind of like your platoon sergeant. And you come in without a tie, he calls y'all, "Hey man, where's your tie?" "All right, well, come to my office. I've got extras." And so it's kind of good. It kind of gets you back into that attention to detail, helps you learn how to be a professional in the government, civilian, by using the same principles that you used in the military, but not making it military-esque, just kind of using the same discipline, attention to detail, and being able to relate with each other because everybody was military. And we had a lot of mental health issues in that class, in that cohort. There was a lot of after hours counseling sessions where people would call people and you had to go to their hotel or go separate them from their wife. I mean, it was a wild program because a lot of us were just coming off of active duty, had no clue what we're going to do with the rest of our lives, and still trying to figure out what PTSD is and deal with those symptoms. And but we finished the program. I think out of 20, there was 24 of us. I think 20 of us graduated. And the ones that didn't graduate is because they quit. And they give you job placement with either the VA, NIH, National Institute of Health, GSA, or DOD. And you become a contract specialist or acquisition specialist. So I chose DC. That's where I got placed. And I've been there ever since. Finished my degree, my bachelor's degree. And then, now I'm doing great. Met my wife. while I was here in the program, the old-fashioned way, okay, Cupid. And she, my wife's actually a lieutenant colonel in the Army. And it really helped when I met her too, because it she really helped me accept my new path in life, because she was completely different than any other woman I've ever been with. My new job field and career field was completely different than anything I ever thought I'd be doing. So it was kind of like all these new things just lined right up and helped me strive, helped me, really start taking off. And, and throughout my whole life, everybody's always, I was just telling my wife the other day, I'm always the guy that's hooking people up. I'm always the guy that people are calling for info, for advice. Who's my person? Who do I get to call? When am I gonna have somebody to call? And that's my wife when I met her. So,
That's
yeah.
awesome.
Yep.
Well, it sounds like Wyoming was very therapeutic for you in a way that you didn't necessarily maybe intend for it to be, but it sounds like that was a really good, needed experience in your journey.
Yeah, I went there to party. I went there to hang out, to roam around the West. I've never been to the West, so I went to just go see the sights. I went to hang with my boy who, free place to live, single now, see what I could get into, and yeah, going and working on that ranch was the best thing I ever did. And then also while I was out there, I got a job as a truck driver too for a little bit. I got my CDLs while I was out there. I was driving a big freaking semi truck around the desert and used to send videos to people. They're like, "What the hell are you doing?" Like, I'm a truck driver, dog.
That's awesome. So when you talk about your really just your military experience and your experience after the military, is there anything, if you had the choice, is there anything that you would have done differently?
I think that, I don't know. It's hard to say that because every decision that I've made has led me to the point that I'm at today. And without getting emotional, I am like truly blessed to have the life that I have now. It was a long road, but I really seeing my daughters every day and being able to be with them every day. I work remote and I work from home. Got a great paying job. My wife has a great paying job. Our quality of life's great. Our kids are healthy. We're healthy, and really where I came from and how I came up, this was not supposed to be the life that I have. This was not in the cards for me. So I kind of defied all the odds. I'm the only person in my whole family, entire family, that's ever been to college and graduated.
That's incredible.
Only person with a college degree in my entire family. And not to brag, but just, I wasn't supposed to make it. I had all the cards stacked against me from the time I was a kid.
Well, I think your story is absolutely incredible and needs to be heard more. And so I am so grateful that you decided to share your story on Your Story Doesn't End Here. I do want to talk a little bit more about the Scout Sniper Association that you're part of, how you got involved in that, and what all does that entail? I know you kind of talked about it a little bit at the beginning, but for people that maybe would be interested in something like that, what does it entail? What do you guys do?
So Marine Scout Snipers, it's a very close-knit community because it's very small. At any time, I think even in the height of like OIF, OEF, there's never been a time where there's been more than, I want to say, 250 to 300 Marine Scout Snipers in existence. And that leaves a very small community. It leaves a very tight-knit community. And it's kind of like that 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon. Within, like, if somebody claims they're a Marine sniper, within two or three text messages, I can find out. You know what I mean? So that's kind of why the Marine Corps Scout Sniper Association was started, because our history goes all the way back to World War I, first off. The Marine Scout Snipers started in World War I. We fought in every conflict. And when we started the association, in 1998, that's when we started. It was just to kind of preserve that brotherhood and preserve that just preserve the community. And there was nobody that was really speaking out or helping Marine snipers per se. And there's all kind of other different nonprofit groups out there, but there was never one for just Marine snipers. So that was kind of the reason this was started. So I knew about it when I was enlisted, but when you're enlisted and you're active, all these nonprofit organizations and all these things that are predominantly made up of people that are out, that are not active duty, they don't really mean as much to you. They're not as important to you until you get out, and you kind of overlook it while you're in. But once you get out, you realize, man, I missed the Marine Corps. I miss, what can I do? I got to, well, Scout Sniper Association. That's how I got back in. And I wasn't ready to do anything like that until last year. You know, last year, the current president started reaching out to all members. He just went down the list and started calling people, like 2,000 people, and just introducing himself and saying, hey, we're about to do an election for board members, board of directors. Is anybody interested? And he called me and he was telling me that. I was like, you know what? Maybe. I don't know. You know, what's it entail? I don't know if I got time. He's like, well, it's not a huge pool, man. He's like, just let me know if you're interested. So I talked to my wife and she was like, well, it's up to you. So I said, all right, well, you can put me on the ballot. And there's like five of us on the ballot for that year, for last year. And he emailed me, or he called me, because he sent an email out to all the members and was like, hey, this is the ballot. These are the members that are on for the board of directors. If you know anything bad or good about any of them, please let me know directly. And he said, I got crickets from everybody on the list. No yeses or nos. He said, except for you, I got like six emails from people, like giving kudos and saying, yeah, you definitely need that guy on your board. And once he told me that, I was like, all right, I've got to, you know, people, I've impacted somebody. So let me use that and help out. So I did. And this last year, the association is just keeping on getting traction. You know, I've got a lot of my old friends from that time frame when I was in that are now active with the association that have never been. We just had a big reunion, 25-year anniversary reunion in Quantico, Virginia, a couple weeks ago. Had over 100 people attend. So everything's going really good right now with the association. We're growing, continue to grow, continue to get people, get donations and donors and sponsors. And, you know, it's a complete nonprofit. Nobody gets paid on our board of directors or our officers. And then when I made board of directors, it wasn't but a couple months when I was getting basically DM saying, hey, would you be interested in being the vice president? Hey. And so then I got voted in as the vice president. And so now I'm taking on more of a role, but it's great. You know, we just had a skydiving event up in Massachusetts a month or two ago. They had a good turnout. And we just try to do anything we can to get people active and connected. They were snipers, you know, because each little event we hold, you know, different people come out of the woodwork. And it's like, oh shit, where have you been for 20 years? You know, oh yeah, I've been around. And everybody's getting their number, and then you're, you know, you're just reconnected like you never left. So,
if someone wanted to support this particular nonprofit, where would they go to make a donation or support?
Okay, our website is scoutsniper.org. One word, scoutsniper.org. We've got a donation. You can click donate. Also, we've got a section on there that you can click request help. And that is, if you know anybody that's a Marine Scout sniper or served in a sniper platoon, family, anybody, and they're in need of anything, please let them reach out to us and we'll see what we can do to help. We get requests all the time. I think we've probably got five or six active requests right now that we're actively working. All of our board of directors jump in, and you know, we just got a guy put into a inpatient rehab last week. We've got people that their son is having a hard time because his father died, was a sniper. His father died, and they may need somebody to help mentor their son. So we'll find a Marine that's in that area, sniper, that'll go and like meet with the kid and try to mentor him. And you know, it's all kind of things that we do. We send guys to dog handler classes and to, you know, for up their service dogs. But really, really anything. We've paid childcare for a family because you know the husband was injured or had cancer, or they pop up all the time. And that's our main goal is that. That's why we're here. Secondary is just networking and keeping the community alive.
That's incredible. And I always love hearing about smaller nonprofits that are very much geared towards a specific goal or a specific community, because there are thousands, like you said earlier, there's thousands of nonprofits out there, especially in the veteran community. And a lot of them are very broad. But I think raising awareness for these more smaller community-based ones is so important. So I really appreciate that you brought that up, and I hope that if you're listening to this episode and you feel called to donate, please do. I know for organizations like this, even small donations, even if they're recurring or one time, they really do make the biggest difference. So I hope that people do donate towards this organization, because I think it's so important what you guys are doing. JT, thank you again for taking the time to be on the show. Your story is absolutely incredible. I know there are people that are going to be impacted by hearing what you've been through, what you've overcame, and how you made it through to the other side and where your life is at now. It's truly a testament to what is possible. So I'm going to leave the audience today with whatever last words or advice that you want to leave them with, and I'll pass it off to you for that.
Hey, well, if I have any saved rounds, I would like to maybe talk about something that once I started doing these kind of things, I really started seeing my life change for the better, and not only my own personal mental health, but every aspect of my life, being a father, husband, employee, teammate, everything. And that is, I started kind of researching mindfulness and doing mindfulness training, and you know, basically, what that is kind of living in the moment, paying attention to everything that you do, finding joy in simple pleasures, you know, like everything, you know, breakfast with your kid, getting down on the floor at night with your kid when you really don't want to, but get down on the floor and play with them. All these kind of things, it really starts sending, it's like a domino effect with your life. Some examples I could say were probably like, you know, just pay attention to slow down. It's hard sometimes to slow down and notice things when you're so busy. Everybody's so busy nowadays. But if you can take the time and experience your environment, you know, your senses, touch, sound, sight, smell, taste, all these different, you know, get outside. You don't have to go hike the Appalachian Trail, but just to get outside and go for walks outdoors, go in the woods. All these different things really help you disconnect and reset yourself. Reduce screen time, you know. It's a habit for everyone. Just put your phone down and set non-negotiable rules for yourself. Like, you know, I'm going to do an hour of exercise every day. I don't care what it is, but I'm going to sweat every day. It's non-negotiable. If I have to do 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, at the end of the day, I'll have an hour. And, you know, don't negotiate yourself. Don't negotiate something, a rule. Another thing that we do also is we have no screen time at the table, no phones at the table with the kids, and we try to eat dinner together every night at the table and talk about their day. And you know, you learn so much about your kids and how smart they are and what they're actually learning, just sitting down and taking that time with them. And you know, take care of yourself. Take care of yourself. If you're having issues, address them. You know, you can't be the best version of yourself if you're not addressing your own issues. You can't be the best husband or father either. And that's really it. You know, I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a motivational speaker, but I'm somebody that is speaking off of things that I know that I've done from a long, complicated, chaotic life that I've had of ups and downs and different endeavors. And there's tons of my story I hadn't told, but I know this is a short podcast, but I just wanted to, like I said, professionally for me and mentally for me, I wanted to start getting my story out there so that people could hear that there's a lot of other people out there like them, and life's not perfect, and everybody's fucked up in their own way. It's just you just gotta learn how to live with it. That's really all I gotta say.
Thank you for taking the time to listen in today. With your support, we are able to increase awareness of the mental health issues affecting service members and veterans today with the goal of creating positive change. If you got value from this episode, please take 30 seconds to subscribe and share this episode within your own network. Until next time, remember, your story matters, your mental health matters, and your story doesn't end here.